Chapter 5. They put me in a room marked Interview A, which I suppose was fitting for a girl who spent her whole life striving for A's, the perfect report card, GPA, SAT, and LSAT scores, bar exam results, all the way through employee evaluations. Because where did all those A's lead me to but here, this narrow, windowless room, where I would soon be interrogated as if I were a murderer. I sat on a cold stainless steel bench, anchored to a cold stainless steel table. Facing me was a 6-foot expanse of mirror that I knew was a mirror on this side only. A video camera was mounted above it and aimed straight at me. I couldn't tell whether the camera was recording, and I couldn't guess whether anyone was watching on the other side of the mirror. But I assumed both were true. Always conduct yourself as if people are watching you, Mrs. Casco used to say, and this time it might literally be true. She'd been my guidance counselor, and she'd guided me from 7th grade all the way into law school, so I was inclined to follow her advice. When I was first ushered into this little room, I asked for and received a cup of black coffee. I drank it straight down, laid my head on the table, and took a caffeine nap. I woke 15 minutes later, exactly on schedule. But I felt only marginally refreshed. The technique used to work like a charm when I was at the Jackson Reader's firm. I worked a lot of late nights in those days, overnights too, often enough that I learned to always keep a complete change of clothes in the office. But that was 5 years ago. My old trick wasn't working now. On the end wall of Interview A was a large video screen. Above it was a digital clock. 2 hours had passed, according to the glowing green digits. It was tomorrow. On the other end wall of Interview A was the door into the corridor that led to the CID bullpen. I didn't know whether the door was locked, and I was afraid to try the knob. If anyone were watching from behind the magic mirror, they'd take it as a sign that I was being uncooperative. But after 2 hours, I almost wondered if they'd forgotten me. Something else was going on here in police headquarters, something big. When I was ushered into my little room, the CID bullpen was a hubbub of activity. Uniformed officers were escorting young women to and from the desks of the detectives. Other officers were frog-marching, shady-looking men in handcuffs. There was a babble of voices, mostly in foreign tongues. I guessed that it was the aftermath of a news story I'd read online at the office this morning, or yesterday morning. According to the article, a multi-jurisdictional task force had conducted sweeping raids on dozens of motels and massage parlors in the tri-state area. Operation Super Bowl, it was called, because the motels and massage parlors turned out to be pop-up brothels, catering to the visiting football fans, men who were out for a good time every way they could get it. Some news accounts called the women in question prostitutes, while others called them victim workers, which explained why the women looked both frightened and combative as the detectives questioned them. They weren't sure whether they were being held as victims or witnesses or suspects. I could commiserate. Which one was I? If I were a victim, the police would have taken my statement at the scene and driven me home. If I were a witness, they would have taken my statement at the scene and let me go, just as they did for the janitorial workers. Those men weren't fingerprinted or photographed or swabbed for DNA. But I was. You decide who you want to be, Mrs. Casco often told me. Then be that person. Visualization, she called it. Visualize yourself as the person you want to be. When you see yourself that way, others soon will too. In 7th grade, I knew only that I didn't want to be what I was. The late-in-life accidental child of a beer-swilling, chain-smoking, spandex-wearing, good-time girl wannabe. But with Mrs. Casco's guidance, I soon figured out what I did want to be, and she taught me how to visualize it. I pictured myself as a superstar, smart, athletic, popular, the girl everyone wanted to know. By the time I reached 9th grade, everyone else saw me that way too. Now I wanted to be a witness, only a witness. So that was what I would be. Only a witness, but also the only witness. I alone could tell the police what happened in that elevator. I was here as a good citizen, a volunteer to help them sort through the evidence and arrive at the truth of the matter. I wouldn't be defensive or cagey, and I wouldn't be weepy or shaken, no matter how I might be feeling. My account would be the only one they would ever get. So long as it was plausible, so long as I was straightforward, they'd have to accept it as true. History was written by the victor, or so they said. I wouldn't exactly call myself the victor, but I was the survivor, which meant I was the one to write the history of what happened in that elevator. The image flashed again in my memory, of Lucy's eyes in the seconds before her death, eerily lit by the cone of light shining up from her phone. They were the crazed eyes of a caged animal. The smooth, lacquered shell of her everyday armor was completely shattered. I felt sick again with the memory, and I had to swallow back the bile and blink hard to clear away the image. I couldn't afford to be sick now, or weak. I needed to keep my own armor up until this was all over. At 2:35, finally, a knock sounded on the door. It was nothing more than two taps, a warning that the door was about to swing inward. Still, I called out, "Come in," stupidly, like I was a lady in her parlor receiving callers. Detectives Riley and Cruz entered the room. They'd shed their overcoats. Riley wore a rumpled brown suit that sagged at the knees and elbows. Cruz wore a sleek gray suit that was a little too tight through the arms and chest and thighs. He had the body of a fitness buff and clearly wasn't shy about showing it off.
"Sorry to keep you waiting," Cruz said as they took their seats opposite me.
"That's all right," I said. "I'm here to help." Riley leaned back in his chair, while Cruz leaned forward and opened a folder. He stroked his goatee between his thumb and forefinger as he sorted through some papers. It was a habit I'd noticed earlier. I thought that the goatee must be new and unfamiliar to his touch. He took out some papers and slid them across the table.
"Just a few formalities, if you don't mind."
He slid a pen at me, too. I picked up the forms and read them. One bore the full text of the Miranda warnings, followed by a waiver of my right to remain silent, a waiver of my right to counsel, and separate signature lines for each. I signed it. The second form was a consent to all the tests already done by the forensics team at Marketplace Tower.
"Just routine," Cruz said.
A retroactive consent wasn't routine. They were dotting every I and crossing every T. And I didn't know whether they were being so careful because I was a lawyer or because I was a suspect. Regardless, I signed that one too. The third document was a consent for a search of my residence. I hesitated over this one. I thought about the state of the apartment when I'd last seen it. I thought about David and whether he'd be there and what he might do or say if he was.
"What would you even be searching for?" I asked.
"It's just routine," Cruz said again.
"But what specifically?"
He shrugged. "Anything that might connect you to the deceased. Your phone, your computer, anything that might connect you to the gun. Ammo, a gun safe. This is all just routine elimination work."
"The gun was Lucy's," I said. "Didn't you check the registration?"
"It's not registered. It's a ghost gun."
I peered at him.
"A goat gun?"
"Ghost," he said,
exaggerating the enunciation.
"Homemade."
"Wow. Really?"
"So far, we can't tell whose it was."
"You should tell the lab to check for fingerprints on the remaining bullets in the cylinder. That'll tell you who loaded it, which would establish who it belonged to."
Cruz glanced at Riley,
who lifted one shaggy eyebrow.
"Sounds like you know your way around guns,"
he said. I saw the trap and sidestepped it. "No, but I read a lot of mysteries. You pick things up."
"Yeah, right,"
Riley said.
"Between that and CSI and Law and Order, everybody's an expert."
Anyway, Cruz looked uncomfortable with Riley's sarcastic tone, almost apologetic.
"It turns out the cylinder was empty, and there aren't any usable prints on the spent casing or on the trigger."
Oh, I considered that. No registration, no fingerprint evidence, nothing to point to me as the owner or the shooter of that gun. "Well, it wasn't my gun," I said. "You won't find anything in my apartment to connect me to it, or anything to connect me to Lucy beyond the fact that we work for the same company." I dashed my signature across the bottom of the last consent form. "But feel free to look. The key's in my purse. You have that, I think?"
"Thank you."
Cruz put the forms in the folder and closed it.
"Need anything before we get started? Something to drink? A bathroom break?"
"I'm fine." He reached under the table, and a green light began to glow on the camera above the mirror. Recording must now be underway. The camera was pointed over the shoulders of the detectives so that their faces and their facial expressions would remain off camera. Only their voices would be recorded, and they'd be sure to keep those perfectly neutral, while my every expression, down to the smallest tick, would be captured on video. The face I wanted the detectives to see was cooperative, compliant, and above all, innocent. And that was the face I tried to show them now. Cruz established the preliminaries, time and place, persons in the room, consent forms signed and acknowledged. He was doing the spade and shovel work of this interview, while Riley sat back and looked bored. I could see the dynamic of their partnership. Cruz was the young up-and-comer, eager and disciplined and by the numbers, while Riley was probably cruising through the second or third extension of his mandatory retirement date, doing little more than punching a clock until he punched out for good. Cruz asked me to state my name, then my address, and when I named my street in the Bronx, I could see his surprise. He'd expected me to live somewhere better. So had I once. Married? Yes, to David Lambert. And I could see his surprise again. Professional women of my generation typically used their own names.
"What's your maiden name?"
he asked. My birth name, I thought. But this was not the time to school him on gender politics. Chance.
Chance? Like gamble?
Like possibility, I used to like to retort. But not this time. I nodded. Next, he asked about employment, and I confirmed that I worked for CDMI in its law department. And yes, I was a lawyer.
"Where'd you go to law school?"
"In the city, Columbia."
"When did you graduate?"
2006.
"Wait."
He flipped some pages.
"You're 30, right?"
"That's right."
"Most people don't finish law school until they're 25. You were 23?
I shrugged. I skipped a couple grades.
"Wow,"
he said. Then,
"Where'd you go to undergrad?"
"Brown. That's in Rhode Island." I wondered if next he was going to ask for my resume and two letters of recommendation.
"Ever work in a machine shop?"
"What?" I said, baffled. If we were in court, I would have said, "Objection, relevance?" But I was here to cooperate. "No."
"Any experience in machining?"
"No, I'm not even sure what that means."
"Working with metal parts? Cutting, boring, assembling?"
"Then definitely no."
"What about your husband?"
"David?" I couldn't help a short laugh. "No."
"You went to the office this morning. I mean, yesterday morning. At what? 6:30?
"About that, yes."
"And stayed until 9 p.m.
"Yes."
"Long hours?"
"Yes."
"And on Super Bowl Sunday?"
"I don't really follow sports."
"What was the big crisis that made you work, what, 14 hours on Super Bowl Sunday?"
"It wasn't any crisis. It's just a big case. and I'm still new to the company. I want to make a good impression.
What's the case?
Palmer versus Duval. It's a shareholder derivative action against the company's top executives, alleging waste and mismanagement in the operation of our overseas production facilities. The company's only a nominal party, so we're not exactly defending against the lawsuit. The executives have their own outside counsel for that. But we, the company, that is, have to respond to discovery requests. And that's what my assignment is, to go through all of the documents from the factories in Southeast Asia and organize them to produce to the plaintiff's attorney. It's kind of a massive undertaking. That was more than Cruz wanted to know. He stroked his beard while he skimmed his notes.
When did you start working at CDMI?
He asked next.
Just
last month, January 2nd.
Did you practice law anywhere before that?
Yes, at Jackson Reeders LLP.
That's the big law firm on Wall Street?
Big law firm, period. It had a roster of Fortune 500 clients and offices all over the world. Yes, I said.
When did you start there?
September 5th, 2006.
Until?
December 19th. My voice trailed off.
2013.
He finished for me. No, 2008.
5 years ago.
Yes.
Where'd you go from there?
I took some time off. Cruz paused and shuffled some papers.
What time did you arrive at the office yesterday?
Asked and answered, I would have said, if we were in court. Instead, I said, about 6:30 a.m.
Who else was there in your office?
No one.
Were you planning to meet someone?
No. It seemed he wasn't going to return to my 5-year gap in employment. He didn't register how significant it was. An Ivy League educated lawyer, hired by one of the top law firms in the world, didn't simply take off 5 years at the start of her career. There were no parking pads on that road to success. I glanced at Riley, but he didn't seem struck by it either. Neither of them thought to ask, what happened on December 19th? Chapter 6. December 19th, 2013. Don't be nervous, David said. But did he? He couldn't have. Yet I could hear him speak the words so clearly. I could feel his lips nuzzle my ear and his arms wind around my waist as we stood at our floor-to-ceiling windows. I could feel the smile on my face and see the sun in its sparkling ascension over the towers of the city. Sparkling. Everything was sparkling. The bright light of dawn, the polished wood floors of our brand new apartment, the gleaming stainless steel in our gourmet kitchen, the decorator-designed Christmas tree in our living room, the platinum rings on our newlywed fingers. This was how we greeted each day, beginning with our very first morning in the apartment, even before our first stick of furniture was delivered. We made love on the living room floor that night and slept there with our limbs entwined, then rose naked to the dawn and stood hand in hand with all of the New York paradise spread out before us. We were primordial man and primordial woman, I thought. We were Adam and Eve, basking in our garden of earthly delights. I didn't say it out loud because David would think it was silly. But it was worse than silly. I knew that now. It was a jinx. Because Adam and Eve fell, didn't they? They lost everything. Don't be nervous. You're a star. I could hear him say it, but he couldn't have. Not when he was passed out cold in the sagging beanbag chair, with his legs sprawled out so far I had to step over them to get from the bed to the tub. Cold. The whole room was cold. I banged on the radiator, and it let out a single gasp before it lapsed into silence again. It was like the death rattle of a corpse. 3 more steps to the kitchen, and I turned on the oven and opened the door, and waited for a shimmer of heat to radiate out before I moved to the tub. At least the boiler was still working. The hot water met the chill air, and a cirrus cloud of steam wisped through the tiny studio apartment. David flung an arm over his face and snorted once before he fell silent again. It sounded like the death rattle of another corpse. "Don't be nervous," he said, but he didn't. "Not today. I was hearing an echo from 5 years ago. Time was all mixed up in my head today. My first callback in over a year, and it had to be on December 19th? How could it not be a jinx?" "Don't be nervous," he said on that other December 19th. "But I wasn't. Not then. I had no reason to be." "You're a star," he said, and I knew it. I woke up that morning early and eager, a rising star poised to accept all the accolades I was certain to receive in my annual performance review that afternoon. Certain because each of my supervising partners had taken me aside to tell me so. They'd even shown me the glowing evaluations they'd submitted to management. Their reviews were the equivalent of a 4.0. Top marks, they said. The best evaluation they'd ever given. They wanted to stroke my ego, to show me how much they appreciated my work. The associates were all competing against one another for these evaluations, but the partners were engaged in their own competition too, to snag the best of the associates to work on their cases. After all, a lawyer was only as good as his team. The law was a business with little value in the way of hard assets. Human capital was everything. And among the class of third-year associates at Jackson Reeder's LLP, I was the capital capital. I leaned back in the tub and submerged to rinse my hair, then stepped out into the cold and huddled under a towel in front of the oven. If only the interview weren't today, today of all days. "Don't be nervous," David said. But I wasn't then. It was he who was. He'd been nervous for 6 months and verging on panic the last three, ever since Lehman Brothers collapsed into the biggest bankruptcy filing in history. September 15th, 2008, a date that will live in infamy. Already, Wall Street was calling it the day the world ended. The Dow plunged, the housing market tanked, unemployment spiked. The credit markets dried up, which meant that the merger and acquisition work that David's investment bank depended upon was dead. His bonus wouldn't be as lavish this year. His assured promotion from associate to VP would doubtless be delayed. He'd never worried about money before, but now he did. Constantly. We'd overpaid for the apartment, he fretted. Our student loan debt was crushing. Our liabilities hung like a black miasma over his head. But I was sanguine. I was a litigator, after all, and my work wasn't threatened by the recession, no matter how great. When times were bad, the first thing anyone wanted to do was sue somebody. Litigation was as inevitable as death and taxes. My own year-end bonus would surely have enough fat to offset the lean in David's. And with a little belt tightening, the bump in my base salary would carry us through until he made VP the following year. That was what marriage was about, right? Pooling resources, sharing the burdens. Neither of us could have afforded the apartment on our own, but the bank was happy to make the loan when we applied for it together. And we'd done a brilliant refinancing of our combined student loans. By co-signing for each other, we'd reduced the interest rate by 2 points, which made a huge difference on a $500,000 debt. Joint and several obligation was the legal term. We each owed the whole amount individually, but we also owed it all together, because that was what marriage was all about. The law of unintended consequences. In 5 years, our debt would be all we had in common, and the only thing that kept us together. My beige suit, sponged and pressed last night, hung from the clothesline that stretched across the room. I stepped carefully over David's prolapsed legs to reach it. I'd worn it with a black shirt for my first interview at CDMI, so today I'd wear it with a white shirt and hope nobody would notice it was the same suit. Once I had a closet full of designer clothes, but I'd sold them all, on eBay and in consignment shops, piece by piece, like an impoverished royal selling off her jewels, and realized almost nothing for them. It turned out designer clothes were like new cars. They lost half their value the minute you wore them off the lot. I turned off the oven and pulled the blanket from the bed and spread it over David and tucked it up to his chin. I wished he'd wake up and say it again. Don't be nervous. You're a star. This was the first callback I'd had for a real lawyer job in over a year. I was fighting not to let myself hope, to steel myself against the pain of another disappointment. But hope sneaked in anyway, and the more I hoped, the more nervous I became. "Say it," I whispered. But he slept on. We met at a merger, two mid-size law firms aimed to increase both their prestige and their average profit per partner numbers by pooling their personnel. I was on the litigation due diligence team for Firm A. David was on the financial due diligence team for Firm B. The closing was attended by more than 30 lawyers and accountants and investment bankers, and the conference room buzzed with a dozen separate conversations, live and through headsets. David was busy running numbers on his laptop, and I was occupied with the closing document inventory. Still, I noticed him across the crowded room. I noticed the mop of golden hair, the square jaw, the nice bulge of biceps inside his shirt sleeves. I didn't usually go for pretty boys. "You be the pretty one," Mrs. Casco always told me. "Find somebody smart instead." But I could tell he was smart, too, by the way the other men on his team listened when he spoke, the way they nodded when he corrected them. But what I noticed most was that he was noticing me. It was more than noticing. He recognized me, and I him. We could each see the glow of ambition that burned like a signal fire in the other. We could see in each other a clear frontrunner in the meritocracy race. No legacy admissions for us, no family connections, no quota assistance. We came from nothing, but were certain one day to have everything. We were self-made in the self-making. Golden boy, meet golden girl. The merger closing was followed by a celebratory dinner, and the same 30 people exchanged the conference table for a long banquet table at an uptown steakhouse. We sat in the same scrimmage lines we'd occupied during the day. But after the starter course, David pulled off a sleight-of-hand shuffle that landed him into the seat next to me. As a dozen increasingly drunken and raucous conversations roared around us, we bent our heads low and spoke only to each other, while our neglected ribeyes oozed red blood over our plates. We swapped resumes, but it was like reading our own, both raised by single mothers always teetering on the edge of poverty, attended public schools where we not only survived but prevailed. We captained teams, won popularity contests, and graduated first in our respective classes. Then on to college, Brown for me, Harvard for David, paid for in small part by merit scholarships and in enormous part by student loans. Then Columbia Law for me and Harvard B School for David, and another layer of student loans on top of the first. And now here we were, a first-tier law firm for me, a major iBank for David.
"Not bad for poor white trash," he said.
And I threw my head back and let out a laugh, because I knew we would have the last one. Before dessert, we found ourselves in the restroom, his pants down, my skirt up, our bodies coming together with the inevitability of water seeking its own level. We never returned to the table. Instead, we grabbed our coats from the hat check girl and ran laughing out into the street. A fine mist was in the air, and it beaded on our faces like dewdrops. David threw up his arm, and the cab cut into the curb.
"Shall we do yours or mine?" he asked.
I turned and looked down the avenue. The street lamps, the traffic lights, the illuminated storefronts, the shimmering facets of the spire on the Chrysler building. They danced and sparkled in the swirl of the mist. "Neither," I said, and lifted my arms like a maestro to take in all the dazzling beauty of the city. "Let's do ours." He knew what I meant. With a smile, he waved off the cabbie and took my hand, and we plunged together into the night. We wandered the empty streets for hours, talking, laughing, sometimes singing, sprinting through red lights and splashing through puddles, stopping to kiss at every tourist landmark in the city. Manhattan was ours, and we were hers. We made our way south, like homing pigeons, to the financial district. He pointed out his building, and I pointed out mine, and we heel-toe walked the distance between them and declared we were practically neighbors. The night was ending by the time we reached Battery Park, and we ambled along the esplanade as the stars winked out and the sky turned from black to gray, and the boats glided ghost-like through the harbor. When the first fingers of sunlight began to steal out over the water, I leapt onto the base of a lamppost and swung circles around it while I crowed an exultant greeting to the dawn. I expected David to laugh. I hoped he would join in. But he did neither. I turned and found him gazing up at me with a look of disbelief on his face. I felt suddenly ridiculous. I'd let my guard down. He'd seen too much of me. I climbed down.
8 million people in this city, he said slowly. I never thought I'd find it. But you're it, aren't you?
His eyes were full of wonder, and I realized he hadn't seen too much of me at all. What he'd seen was himself, his perfect match, and I mine.
You're the one, aren't you? He said. The one I've been looking for.
My whole life. I finished for him. And he threw his head back and let out his own cock-a-doodle-doo until I stopped his mouth with a kiss that lasted until the world lit up all around us. We never went home that night, to his or mine. We were both at our desks by 9. But within a month, his home was mine. Within a year, we were married. I pulled on my coat and glanced up at the window, where a parade of legs passed by. This was how I checked the weather each day, gauging the temperature outside by the proportion of bare legs and the precipitation by the splash of feet past the window. We didn't have a TV or internet connection or even a landline telephone. Those were all things that were hard to get after your credit was destroyed by million-dollar debts. It's like we're Amish, I joked the day we moved into the basement studio. But David didn't laugh. He didn't find me funny anymore. Or anything else. It shouldn't have been so hard to be poor again, not when we'd been rich for only a tiny fraction of our lives. By balance sheet measures, we'd never been rich at all, or even solvent. But poverty was harder the second time around. Crueler. To have things, then to not have them. To be admired, then ignored. To be full of promise, then empty of everything but regret. I watched the feet of the world pass by, men and women striding purposefully to work, to shop, to learn, to prosper. Everyone else had recovered from the Great Recession. They'd been retrained, landed new jobs, had their debts forgiven. The banks and insurance companies and automakers were bailed out to the tune of $700 billion. Too big to fail, they were called. But I was small, small enough to fail. And I did, spectacularly. Outside, the legs were sloshing through puddles, and I picked up my umbrella and left. That other December 19th, we bounded out of our building hand in hand into the bright, cold morning. The shopkeepers and doormen waved and smiled at us as we strode down the block. We were the golden couple of Chelsea, and so alike, David with his sun-bleached hair, me with my $200 highlights, he in his Hugo Boss top coat, me in my belted alpaca from Barney's. At the corner, we hailed a cab for our commute down to Wall Street, and one obligingly stopped beside us, our chariot awaiting. We got on our phones as we rode, David texting, me talking, our free hands entwined on the seat between us. My stop came first, a quick kiss goodbye, then he said it again, "Don't be nervous." I should have realized then, but I didn't. Not until I arrived home in the middle of the afternoon. I unlocked the door and stopped short when I heard music playing in the living room. Bags of shopping sat on the kitchen counter, a magnum of champagne, a wheel of brie, a dozen red roses. "Hello?" I called thickly, my throat burning with unshed tears. I came around the corner to find David on a stepladder, hanging a banner across the wall of glass. "Congratulations, Shay," it read. "You're a superstar." The tears came then. He jumped down from the ladder and held me close as I sobbed out my devastating news. "I'm sorry, babe. I'm so, so sorry." He choked. It wasn't until I felt his arms trembling around me that it occurred to me to ask, "What are you doing home at this hour?" We were alike in every way. He'd been laid off too, way back in October. For Wall Street, the world may have ended on September 15th, but December 19th was the day it ended for us. Chapter 7.
"I wonder if you can help us out with the timeline," Detective Cruz said.
I nodded. "If I can." The detectives had excused themselves about 20 minutes earlier. When they returned, Cruz was carrying a computer tablet. He set it on the table in front of him.
"Your building's equipped with CCTV. Did you know that?"
I nodded again. "There are cameras in the lobby and in the elevator banks on every floor. In the elevators, too. Motion activated, I think."
"Right. Well, building security gave us the feed from the 30th floor."
"Okay." He touched the screen on his tablet, and as it lit up, so did the big TV screen on the end wall of the room. A video started to play, and I recognized the elevator bank on the 30th floor of my office. A blonde woman walked into the frame, turned her back to the camera to face the etched gridwork of the elevator doors, and pressed a finger to the destination touchscreen. The date and timestamp appeared in the upper right corner of the video. Cruz paused the playback.
"Can you identify that person?"
"Yes, that's Lucy Barton Jones."
"Arriving at the 30th floor elevator at 9:02 last night?"
"And 30 seconds, if the timestamp's accurate."
"Any reason why it wouldn't be?"
"Not that I know of." He resumed the playback, and I watched myself enter the frame. I looked a little unsteady on my feet, and I remembered how weak I felt last night, how tired. On screen, I glanced at Lucy. Then I turned to face the elevator doors as well. Cruz paused the video again.
"Can you identify the next person to arrive?"
"That's me."
"You arrived at 9:04?
"That's what the timestamp says. It sounds right."
"Ms. Barton Jones was already there when you arrived?"
"Yes."
"What did you say to her?"
"Nothing."
"No? Look here."
He rewound the video.
"Right before you turn. See there? You look at her and your lips are moving."
I peered at the screen. "Oh, well, I guess I said, hello."
"It looks like you said, I know."
"Does it?" I leaned in as he played it again. "I think it looks like hello."
"What did she say to you?"
"Nothing."
"Even after you might have said hello?"
I'm not sure she knew who I was.
She was the head of HR. Wasn't she the one who hired you?
Well, she extended the offer and did the paperwork. But I only met her then and one other time, briefly. It's a big company. She could have forgotten me. Anyway, she seemed preoccupied, so I just left her alone.
Cruz closed that video file and opened another.
This is the feed from the camera inside the elevator.
This video showed us both stepping onto the elevator, turning toward the doors, and standing in opposite corners. He froze the image there. My expression was impassive, but Lucy's face. Her mouth was open, her eyes dazed, her features frozen into a tight mask. She looked terrified.
Let me ask you again, he said. What did you say to her?
I told you, hello, or how are you? A casual nicety.
Nice.
Riley spoke up.
And she reacts like that?
She wasn't reacting to me. I don't think she even noticed me. She obviously had other things on her mind.
Obvious? Why?
Cruz said. Because she was contemplating suicide. He raised an eyebrow.
Before, you told us she killed herself out of a panic attack brought on by the power failure, which hadn't failed yet.
But she must have been thinking about it. She had a gun in her purse.
If she did,
Riley said. She did. I tamped down the impulse to shout. I mustn't be antagonistic. I reminded myself I was here to help.
Cruz resumed the video playback. It showed us facing the doors until the cage went dark and the camera cut off. The last timestamp on the display was 21.04.55.
The 911 call was received at 9:12.
Okay.
Almost 7 minutes later.
Okay.
Walk us through what happened during those 7 minutes.
I described it. How I groped for the emergency call button and pressed it. That I said something to Lucy. Looks like we're stuck. But she didn't say anything. How I pressed the button again. That I thought someone was supposed to answer through the intercom, but no one did. How I banged on the doors and shouted for help. How I even tried to prize them apart.
What was Ms. Barton Jones doing while you did all that?
It was dark. I couldn't see her. But I could hear her breathing. It sounded labored. I asked her if she was okay, but she didn't answer. I tried the emergency button again, and I banged on the doors again. And when it was finally obvious that no one was responding, I called 911.
On Ms. Barton Jones's phone?
Yes.
Which you got out of her purse,
Riley put in. I swiveled his way. No. No, she took it out. We were in the dark the whole time I was trying to get help. Then there was a sudden glow of light behind me. I turned around and saw that she was staring at the screen. Oh, good idea, I said. Call 911. But she just kept staring. Her mouth was open. It was like she was panting. Okay, let me, I said, and took the phone out of her hands. And then I called 911. Cruz resumed the lead.
How much time passed from the 911 call until the gunshot?
I don't know. I couldn't even guess. It seemed like we were in there for hours. Hours before the shot and hours after the shot, too. It was those hours afterward that stretched out the longest in my memory, trapped in that cage with the smell of smoke and blood.
You had her phone. You didn't glance at the time?
No, I turned it off. The battery was almost depleted. I thought for a minute. The guard, the other men in the lobby, didn't they tell you when they heard the shot?
Unfortunately, no. The janitors were running their floor polishing machines, and they had headphones on. The guard was watching the game on TV. Nobody heard a thing.
Oh, that possibility hadn't occurred to me.
So we don't know when the gun was fired,
Riley put in.
How long after the 911 call? If it was after the 911 call.
What? You think? My mouth dropped open. No, obviously she was still alive when I made that call. You could hear her in the background. We listened to the 911 tape, Cruz said. She never spoke.
No, but... Well, I put the phone to her mouth. She was hyperventilating. You must have heard that.
We heard somebody.
That was Lucy. She was alive when I made that call. I tried to get her to talk to the operator, but she was already in full-blown panic.
Okay, so you made the call. Then what?
I turned the phone off, like I said, to conserve the battery. I told Lucy that help was on the way, but by then she was definitely hyperventilating. I tried to calm her down. Take slow breaths, I said, or something like that. In and out, nice and deep and slow. But she didn't seem to hear me. I reached out to touch her, to stroke her arm or pat her back or something. I kept trying to calm her down. I said, help's on the way, we'll be out of here in no time, everything's fine. You know, like that. But her breathing just sounded worse, and then it sounded like she was gasping, you know? And I turned her phone back on to use the flashlight to see how she was. She was reaching into her purse. I thought maybe she had an inhaler, maybe she had asthma, but it was a gun.
She had a gun in her purse.
I nodded. I kinda reared back, you know? She was staring at it in her hand. I said, oh no, or put that away, or something. Then she put it under her chin.
Show me.
Like this. I mimed a gun with my thumb up and index finger out, then turned my hand until the finger touched the underside of my chin. I screamed, no, and I dropped the phone and lunged for her. I grabbed her hands and I pulled the gun out from under her chin. But she fought me. She fought me so hard. And she twisted her arms around, and my arms too. And then it was like the whole elevator exploded.
The gun fired.
For a second, I didn't know what happened. The phone was still lit up on the floor, and then she was on the floor too, with her eyes wide open and a hole in her face, and everything behind her splattered with blood. I think I screamed again, and then the battery died and everything went black. I closed my eyes as the scene looped through my memory. As terrifying as the fight was, as much as Lucy's crazed animal eyes haunted me, it was even more frightening to be plunged into darkness, alone in the cage with her, while the roar of the gunshot reverberated through my skull.
Then what did you do?
I don't know, I said. Nothing. I should have checked for a pulse, I guess, or given her CPR. I don't know. I guess I was in shock. I pressed myself back into the other corner and stayed there until I heard the elevator start up, until the doors opened. There. I'd told the whole story now. I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Cruz powered down the tablet and the TV screen went black, a clear signal that we were done. I'd been holding my back straight the whole time, but now I let my spine relax.
So here's my question, Riley said.
I turned a startled look his way and sat up straight again.
Why didn't you call 911 yourself? On your own phone? The one we found in your purse?
Oh, that? It's a pay-as-you-go, and I'd forgotten to top it up.
Why didn't you top it up right then? You had a signal. All you had to do was add some money, and you could have kept the line of communication open until help arrived.
I guess I didn't think.
And why are you carrying a burner phone anyway?
What?
You know what a burner phone is. Disposable, anonymous, untraceable. The criminal's best friend.
It's nothing like that.
Then you must be on that dating app. What do you call it? Timber?
Tinder. Cruz quietly corrected him. I felt my face flush. Cruz's questioning had been neutral, almost gentle. He was the good cop, and now Riley was stepping in to play bad cop. I'm not on any dating app, I said. I'm married.
So what's the burner for? Drug deals?
No.
And where's your real phone?
I don't have... I checked myself before I started to shout. Look, I checked myself again. For 5 years, shame had kept me from ever disclosing my financial situation to anyone. But suddenly, I could see that it might work to my advantage. Besides, if they hadn't already run a credit search on me, they soon would. "You can't get a real phone without credit," I said finally. "And I don't have any, so I use a pay-as-you-go. That's all there is to it." Both detectives leaned in at that.
"You're saying you're broke?"
Cruz asked. "Worse than broke. I'm drowning in debt. Student loans, a mortgage deficiency judgment, credit card debt. So yes, I'm in some financial difficulty. Or I was until I got this new job."
"So this job," Cruz said slowly, fingering his beard. "It must be pretty important to you."
I lifted my chin. "It's the most important thing in my life. I would never do anything to jeopardize it. I'm eternally grateful to the people who hired me. And that includes Lucy Barton Jones." I was pretty pleased with my delivery of that last line. And when the detectives left the room immediately after, I thought I might have scored a direct hit. They were probably out there at their desks right now, running a lien and judgment search. They'd confirm that I was in debt and that I had no motive to kill Lucy. I was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. I thought of that old mystery novel trinity of motive, means, and opportunity. The detectives had to check off each of those boxes before they could seriously consider me a suspect. Obviously, opportunity was a given in this case. I was right there beside her, after all. But there was no way they could link me to the means, that is, the gun, and I'd just established that I had no motive to kill Lucy. Quite the opposite, in fact. It was ironic that I had to pull out my poverty and desperation to do it. Those were circumstances that I usually went to great lengths to conceal. But it made sense, and it had the added benefit of being true. I was desperate for this job. I was grateful that I'd landed it. It was only the eternal part that wasn't true. It was a scant 20 minutes before Cruz returned to the room, without Riley this time, and he didn't sit down.
"We appreciate your time, Ms. Lambert," he said.
His tone was more than cordial. It was warm. He wasn't just playing good cop. He liked me, I could tell. Not liked me the way cops on TV shows pegged their target perp, and not liked me in a leering, lascivious kind of way either. He liked me the way a nice boy in junior high liked the most demure good girl in the class. He wanted to carry my books and maybe introduce me to his mother. It was sweet.
"We'll be in touch if we have any more questions," he said. "You're free to go."
"Oh," I surged to my feet, elated. I'd done it. I'd convinced them. But before I started my victory lap, I had to hurdle some practical concerns. "Can I get my clothes back? And my purse?" I had no car, no money for a cab, and I was wearing oversized sweats and paper booties on my feet. And my briefcase. I really needed to get my briefcase back.
"Sorry," he said. "We can't release any evidence until the investigation's over."
I peered at him. "It's not over?"
"Well, no."
He seemed apologetic.
"We still have to execute the searches and run down the manufacturer of the gun kit and interview the family and friends."
He caught himself as he seemed to realize he'd been too quick to share their investigative game plan with me. And I'd been too quick to assume victory. I hadn't convinced them yet. I wasn't exonerated, and the case wasn't closed. They were simply sticking a pin in it for now. I was due back at work in a few hours. Everyone there would soon know that Lucy was dead, and they'd soon hear that I was the only one with her when she died. If they didn't also hear suicide and case closed, I'd have to get through the day with a storm cloud of uncertainty hanging over me. And what if the detectives changed their minds? They could swoop in and arrest me at the office. probably during the pitch of morning arrivals or evening departures, when the maximum number of coworkers would be there to watch them snap on the handcuffs and march me to the elevator. I wouldn't even get to clear out my desk this time. As humiliating as it was to be marched out of Jackson Reader's 5 years ago, this would be a million times worse. No, free to go wasn't good enough. I couldn't leave until I heard the words that mattered. Exonerated, not a suspect, simply a witness to a tragic suicide. Any of those would suffice. You know what? I sat back down. I think I'll stay. Cruz looked flummoxed. You may think of other questions, I said. I may remember additional facts. Either way, I'll be here. He tilted his head to one side. I gotta ask, why are you being so accommodating? Because I have nothing to hide. He wasn't buying it.
Your run-of-the-mill bystander has nothing to hide either, but they can't wait to get out of here. After what you've been through, I'd think you'd be champing at the bit to go home. So how come?
He seemed sincerely curious, so I answered him sincerely. Because it's a zero-sum game, right? There were only the two of us in that elevator. If she didn't do it, then I did. The second that gun went off, it became my job to convince you that I didn't do it. He shook his head.
The burden of proof's always on us. Come on, counselor, you know that.
Not this time. This time the burden's entirely on me. I folded my hands on the table like I was putting down stakes. As long as your investigation's still ongoing, I'm staying right here. He winced a little.
It could be a long night.
I'm used to long nights, I said.